Throughout this hour, we've been talking about humane prisons, and for the most part, the suggestions have been pretty practical. But there's a deeper way to think about justice. Martha Nussbaum is one of the most famous living philosophers, and part of her work involves coming up with new ways to think about social justice and reform. In her latest book, Anger and Forgiveness, she explores the corrosive effect that anger plays in personal relationships, politics, and also in criminal justice systems. She tells Steve Paulson that retribution and payback are not the path to true justice.
In life, it's very easy to believe that if you pay somebody back, that actually improves the situation or balances out the wrong. You know, if your child has been killed, you want to kill the person who did that. But we really have to ask, does that do any good? And actually, proportional wrong for wrong, pain for pain, doesn't in and of itself actually help to restore the thing that was lost.
But is there any case to be made for payback?
Well, I think there's just one situation in which payback actually gets you the thing that you want, and that is where you're seeing the insult as entirely about relative status. I think that, you know, society is full of that, and we really do get angry a lot, but that itself is a very narrow and unfortunate scheme of values. So much better when there is a wrongful damage, and we are pained about it, and we want to do something about it, to then turn to the future and say, what really shall we do?
What about the idea that payback actually serves some other uses as well? It gives victims and their families a sense of closure, for instance. Does that hold any water for you?
Well, you know, people can learn to take pleasure in all kinds of sadistic activities. So, you know, to me, if the thing is wrong, the fact that lots of people take pleasure in it doesn't really cut any ice, because those preferences are learned. And they can be unlearned. People also used to derive a lot of pleasure from raping women and subordinating them.
But so is that really what we're talking about? We're talking about something really bad happened to me. And,
well,
you know, I want to see.
Closure is a fiction. Closure is a fiction. We can trace its history. It was a movement. There's a victim rights movement that started about 20 years ago. And when the critics of victim impact statements in criminal trials first were writing articles about why victim impact statements pervert the equal application of justice, there were very few people asking about closure. And by now, that movement has been very successful, and it's persuaded a lot of people that they'll never get closure unless they stand up in court and appeal for a higher sentence. But, you know, you can trace the history of it, and you can see that it's a social fad, and not every fad should be gratified.
Well, let's take a case that's been in the news recently, the Stanford rape case, where there was outrage over the very light sentence, only 6 months in a county jail, that Brock Turner got after he was convicted of a brutal sexual assault. And the common response was intense anger. He got off way too easily. Justice was not served. And we've got to let everyone know about it so this kind of thing won't happen again.
Yeah, I agree with the outrage. But I think the reason is that this kind of crime is highly deterrable. Now, with athletes, and I actually have had a painful experience in my own history with a famous actor, with famous actors and athletes, they are the last two groups of people in our culture who think they're above the law. They don't have to obey the normal rules. So the reason that it would have been good for him to get a heavier sentence is to put him and all other such people on notice that they're not above the law. But it's not because of retribution we do that. It's because of the future, which we can, of course, change. And it's the only thing that we can change.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned that you yourself had a painful personal experience. What happened?
Yeah, well, I wrote about it on the Huffington Post, so you can get all the details there if you want to. But when I was about 20 years old, I started to date a well-known actor and was sexually assaulted by that actor. And in those days, it was just not going to be possible to go to the police. I record in the piece that later he ran for an important political office. And at that point, which was 20 years after the event, I did think of coming forward because I thought, how outrageous. And I wanted to prevent that person from holding an office of public trust. But what everyone said to me is, you know, he's going to say you're extorting money. He's going to say you're just trying to capitalize on his fame. So, you know, I just didn't do it. But I was happy to note that in obituaries for the guy, there were at least some newspapers, mostly outside the United States, that did mention his bad behavior.
So, I mean, so this was a case where you were angry. Maybe not because
I think I was really, my emotion was what I call transition anger. That is, I thought it was outrageous that he should hold political office, and I wanted to prevent that from happening.
Why not just call that anger? And just, I mean,
because I didn't want payback. I actually hadn't thought of this guy from that day to this. I was not upset. Now, let me just back up one step and say that if we're thinking about crime generally, and if you have the forward-looking attitude that I recommend that says these things are outrageous, you will actually start way further back. You'll think, how do I bring up young people who are not even inclined to create a world where those kinds of crimes skate scot-free? So if we think about the Stanford rapist, sure, yeah, I mean, specific and general deterrence are served by giving him a prison term. But much more important is, how can we bring up athletes and other young people who do not see themselves as able to use the bodies of women as toys? So that's where we should be focusing our energy. And with crime in general, we should be focusing on things like housing, employment, educational opportunities. You know, those are the things that really bring about less crime in society. Once the crime has occurred, it's in a way too late.
It sounds like you're saying that we really need to reform our criminal justice system, which is very much about retribution and about punishment. Are you saying we should, for the most part, get rid of that whole element of punishment?
Well, I am saying that part of our system is retributive and part is inspired by theories of deterrence and reform. It's a real mixture. And that mixture has been around for thousands of years. So it's an old debate, but I think we should drop the retributive part. And what that means is, first of all, backing up and thinking about criminals as not born bad, as people who would probably much prefer not to steal, but if they are brought up correctly with educational opportunities, with nutrition, and so on. So that is a very large social task. We don't really understand how to do it. We have many theories. And so because we despair of succeeding in bringing up people who are not going to be criminals, we fall back on this payback idea. And I think that's really, really unfortunate. So,
But what happens if they do then commit a crime?
Well, if they do commit a crime, then we have to ask, what do we do? Now, as I say, we have a number of legitimate interests. One of them is accountability. We have to make a statement that this is a bad thing so that other people will understand that and they won't do it. So that's general deterrence. And we also have to make a statement to that individual so that individual won't do it. We would hope we might even be able to reform that individual. And so we have to ask, given the type of crime it is, how to balance out those interests? What do we do? And I think there will be other cases where we might use imprisonment, but I think not as many as we do. I mean, think about sexual harassment. Nobody goes to jail for sexual harassment, but they often lose their job. They often have their company have to pay a hefty fine if the company is found to be liable. So those things have proven very successful.
Now, we've been talking about the powerful emotion of anger, and there's another one, a very different kind of emotion you also write about, forgiveness. And I think, you know, there's sort of this common sort of feeling that, oh, forgiveness is kind of a wimpy thing. It's sort of a weak emotion, but that's not the way you see it, do you?
Well, actually, I think we have to, first of all, distinguish different kinds of forgiveness. And the sort of canonical kind of forgiveness is what I call transactional forgiveness. That is, I will waive my angry feelings toward you if you grovel before me, you confess your wrongdoing, say you won't do it again, and so on. It really is a kind of covert form of anger. I'm going to keep punishing you with my anger until you sufficiently humble yourself before me. Now, then we move to what is often emphasized by Jesus in the Gospels, and that's unconditional forgiveness. And we see this in this wonderful response of the people in South Carolina to Dylann Roof's murders.
Oh, it's absolutely astonishing. I mean, the relatives of those 9 people who were murdered, I mean, their response immediately to Dylann Roof was, "I forgive you."
And, you know, even more interesting was the one woman who says, "I still feel really angry, but I know that I'm a work in progress." So that church had given them the sense that this is work. You have to do work on your feelings. And they had been doing that. And I'm amazed at that. I think they were great. So that's unconditional forgiveness. You start with anger and then you waive it unconditionally. And, of course, I think that's vastly superior. Even better, I think, is not to get into the morass of anger in the first place, but maybe just to start out with a generous spirit. Nelson Mandela learned that the best way to approach people who had wronged him was to think, how shall I treat them in order to build cooperation and friendship? The love comes first, and that's the way that Mandela always treated people, that there was a kind of open-hearted generosity that came first, and then his advice to them about what the nation should be like and how it should change came afterwards. So that's what I really like best, and I think it's better in personal relations, but also in political relationships.
Philosopher Martha Nussbaum. She's the author of Anger and Forgiveness, and she talked with Steve Paulson.